Good evening, everybody. My name is Howard. I am a selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, and frightened person. In other words, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you very much. Somebody lost a phone. I'll auction it off at the end of the meeting. They're recording me somewhere. Hello? Hello? Oh, it's on the phone. How do I know about technology, right? It's on the phone. That's neat. Thank you. That's not that Instagram, YouTube stuff, is it? I hope not. Anyway, my name is Howard. I'm an alcoholic. Page 86 in the big book says, nothing will show immunity as extensive work with another alcoholic. Meaning I'm guaranteed not to drink again as long as I'm intensively working with another alcoholic. So that's what I'm doing tonight. I'm going to intensively work with a alcoholic. So hopefully one person in this room is going to get some sort of message that will help them to find a power that's greater than themselves and have that power restore them to sanity, as it says in our second step. Meaning, restoring to sanity is going to be able to see the truth about picking up the first drink, knowing that picking up the first drink is the same as picking up a glass of Clorox bleach. They're both going to kill you. But as an alcoholic, we don't see that. We see what alcohol is going to do for us. We see it's going to give us that, the sense and ease and comfort, which we see others taking, which we see others have once they take a drink. We don't know and we don't remember that alcohol is going to bring us to levels that we've never seen before. And I probably don't have to explain about the first step, that we're powerless over alcohol and our lives are unmanageable. Because if they weren't for you, you wouldn't be here tonight. So it'll be very little about my story of drinking and such, and it'll be a lot of recovery speak. I'm going to mention the big book because I was lucky enough to find a great sponsor, and that sponsor got me right into the book, and that book helped me find a power greater than myself. And that power has relieved the obsession for me to drink. And we'll go through that also. We'll go through the allergy portion, and we'll go through the mental obsession portion. There's chairs up front if you guys want to come on up front. Just find a place to sit. Or if you have some more chairs for people in the back. I don't know if you have any other chairs. Trying to make you comfortable. All right. So I just turned 50 years old last August. I started drinking when I was 13. So you can do the math. I'm celebrating 16 years on March 30th, matter of fact, at Olivet Church in Valley Stream. No gifts, please. Just $100 bills. I'll take that. I'll take that. No, I'm celebrating 16 years at the end of this month, and it's been an unbelievable joy ride. Like I said, I started drinking at 13 at my bar mitzvah in Fresh Meadows. I saw people drinking, and their drinks were left on the table, and there were some with cigarette butts in them, but that didn't matter to me. I just took whatever I could and drank, and I got messed up. Ran upstairs to the bathroom, threw up my guts, came back down, and wanted more. And I guess that's where I started my run on my drinking. So at 13, I started drinking. Right after my bar mitzvah, my family decided that they had enough of my my doings, and they sent me to a school for emotionally disturbed children in upstate New York, and it was the right decision that they made to send me up there, because I was trouble. I was trouble at home, I was trouble at school, I was trouble anywhere I went. I found trouble, or trouble found me. I blamed all my troubles on all of you, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But my family sent me away 18 months. It was a good learning experience. It taught me how to be on my own at 13 years old. When I got out at 16, I introduced my neighborhood to all sorts of drinking and drugs, and because I knew the people that had all that stuff, and it was easy train ride, or whatever it was to go get what I needed and bring it back and sell it or share it with the people in my neighborhood. And my neighborhood was Oceanside. So if I partied with anybody here in Oceanside, I don't remember who you are, but if I owe you money, see me after the meeting and I'll make amends, I promise. So we partied in Oceanside for a couple of years, and as time went on, more trouble found me. The people I was drinking and partying with just decided to start going to bed at 10, 11 o'clock at night, and I was just raring to go at that time. So I had to push them off to the side, and I had to find more people that were like me, that were able to handle their drinking, their alcohol, who had the wooden leg, as my mother used to say. And I found those people. And I found those people in the Bronx, where I was working. I found those people in Queens, where I worked. And those people were the ones that would drink after work. And then we would go to these after-hour places in all of the seedy neighborhoods. And there was even some that weren't in such seedy neighborhoods. But we would drink 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. We would finish drinking and go do what we had to do and get a quick shower and a shave, and then back to work I'd go. And I never missed a day of work physically because of drinking. Was I there mentally? No, most of the time I wasn't. I was half in the bag or three quarters in the bag or fully in the bag. But I never missed it physically. And I guess that was a curse in itself, because I would always say, I'm not as bad as these other people who just don't come to work because, you know, they have hangovers or they're drunk. And that gave me, you know, ammunition to continue on. And as I continued to drink, I needed to find other substances, because drinking wasn't cutting it anymore. And I don't have to tell anybody here what those are. They're not as numerous as they are now. Even the alcohol now is all sorts of fancy flavors and colors and all sorts of things. They didn't have that stuff when I was drinking. It was a good bottle of vodka in the freezer. It was cases, 30 packs in the back seat of the car. It was Drambuie to put me to bed at night because I was so wired up on everything else. And this continued on for a while. Before I got a job in the Bronx, I was working in Queens, like I said, and I was told by my grandfather, who had a appliance and electronics chain, that I was no longer welcome in the business. I would amount to absolutely nothing, and that destroyed me. The person I was working under was about to retire, and I thought I was being prepped to take his position. I thought I was being trained to take this person's position. And when it came to, saying, all right, he's leaving, when do I take his spot? I was told, well, you don't have a future in this business, and you don't have a future here. Destroyed me. But it destroyed me to the point that I said, I will prove him wrong. So I went to his nearest competitor, basically right across the street, someone that he was, in a heated competition with. And you would see, this person would advertise a TV for $99. My grandfather would advertise it for $98. It was that type of competition. He would go 97. Next week, my grandfather would be 96. And it was a heated competition. So I said, you know what? I'm going right over to the competition, and I'll teach you a lesson. And I did. I went to the competition, and I became the youngest store manager in the chain's history. And I did quite well for myself. My monthly bonuses, my override bonuses, were anywhere from $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, and the paychecks were just flying in. I would walk around with wads of cash, and it, to me, it was, you know, piece of cake. It was great. I would take my employees out. I'd hire limousines. We would go to the discos. We'd go out for dinner, wherever they wanted to do, whatever they wanted, I would pay for. Because I had nothing inside of me, and I needed to spend the money so people would like me, because I had no confidence in myself. I had no self-esteem. I felt less than, and alcohol made me feel better. Alcohol made me feel complete. It gave me the things that I couldn't do on my own. It gave me the initiative to be better, to do things better, to drive faster, to go after women, to do whatever I wanted to do. I needed the alcohol, and I noticed that as I was working in the Bronx. 5'7", I weighed 160 pounds at the time, and you know, they called me the short Jewish guy in the Bronx, and everybody that worked with me was African American, Spanish, and they wouldn't mess with me because I was just an animal. I was an animal when it came to things. I wouldn't take anything, and nothing scared me. Nothing fazed me. If someone would get in my face, you know, I would be right back in their face. I had no concerns. If somebody wanted to slit my throat, go for it. Didn't matter to me. I could care less. And I guess that's what made me successful. That's what made me a cutthroat in the business, and what made me the person that I was. And at the end of the day, I'd go into my room and lived by myself, and you know, either drink myself to sleep or drink myself till I passed out or cried, because there was nothing. I had nothing inside of me. This went on for a while, and work was so good that's all I would do. You know, I'd work these 9-to-9 shifts, you know, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, and the seventh day I'd just crash. But it got to the point where I was fighting against myself year after year, and these override checks weren't as good as they used to be. And I didn't have the money to pay for all the things that I needed to do to get me to where I needed to be and to spoil the people around me so I would have friends. So I had to stick my hand in the till to supply the need of my addictions. And at the time, as time went on, I felt, you know, the heat on my neck, and I knew that I was going to get caught. So I left that company, and I blamed them. I said, listen, I want the store over in Rockville Center. I wanted to be the manager of the store at Rockville Center. They said, no, you're too crude. You would never deal with, you know, never get along with the people in Rockville Center, blah, blah, blah. So I said, all right, you know what? Screw you two, and I'll prove that you're wrong. And this time I couldn't prove that he was wrong. They were wrong. I couldn't do it. I was in way over my head. So I left them and blamed them for my failure. At this point, I was living in Woodside, Sunnyside, in a house with two other guys. I had a kitchen and a bathroom, and I had a single bedroom, and I think it was about $300 a month, and I could barely afford that. All the money that I had went up my nose. I drank it. I bought people, and it was an absolute disaster. So living in Queens in a one bedroom, in a shared bedroom or a shared house in a single bedroom, it was pretty much the low point. So I thought. It wasn't a low point. It got worse. It got worse to the point that I had to beg my mother to come, to let me go back home and live with her in Oceanside. And so I figured, you know, I pick up the phone, Mom, you know, it would be great. Well, come home, blah, blah, blah. She said, yeah, no problem, except you got to pay me rent. I said, what? My own mother's going to charge me rent? She says, absolutely. I got to teach you responsibility. Well, I'm 20-some-odd years old. I was a store manager of this. I was this, that, and the other thing. And she had to teach me responsibility. And she was right, because I had no responsibility. The only responsibility I had was finding what I wanted, when I wanted, from who I wanted it from, walking all over anybody I wanted or whatever I needed. And she was right. And that was the low point. Crawling back home and asking her to let me live back in the house and paying her rent. That lasted a couple of months, and I went even lower. My father saw that that it was at bottom, if not below rock bottom, and he called my aunt and uncle who lived in California. And unbeknownst to me, my uncle ran an AA meeting in Chatsworth, California, and they sent me out there with this whole plan that I had no clue of. I got to California. At this time, I owed tens of thousands of dollars to credit cards, to the IRS. It was a sad sight. I was at bottom. I went out to California, got a job at Circuit City, seasonal position. They hired people for Christmas holiday season, and again I was where I was, you know. That's what I knew to do. That's what I knew how to do, was get on the sales floor and sell. And I did that. I did it to the point where I was in the top 3 or 4 in the whole West Coast of California. Numbers that they've never seen any seasonal hire do before. And all of a sudden, boom, would you like to be assistant manager? And I was floored, at this time I was on a $5 a day allowance, because my uncle felt it was the right thing to do to pay back all the people that I owed back in New York, and the bills were sent to California, and he would, you know, dole out the money to these people who I owed: IRS, MasterCard, Visa, American Express. I took out a bank loan to pay for taxes that I couldn't pay, and it was a lot of money that I owed. And he did my banking, gave me $5 a day. And in the beginning, the $5 a day budget worked very well. You know, I'd get coffee in the morning, coffee in the afternoon, and then I would have $4 or $3.50 for lunch, and it worked. And I would drive home if I had to for dinner, and if I had to go back to work, I would. But Circuit City gave me an assistant manager's position, and I was excited about it. And I took the job very seriously, because I thought, again, I had another chance in life. After I ruined everything back here in New York, I had another chance in life. Job went so well. My allowance got increased, and I started hanging out again at night, meeting people. The thing to do was go to the bars, watch the games, or hang out at cantinas, and then I found liquor again, and I started drinking. And the 7 day or 7.50 or $8 or $10 a day allowance wasn't working anymore. So I ended up stealing from my uncle, drinking liquor out of their cabinet. The allowance now was coffee in the morning, all right, coffee in the afternoon, and whatever bottle was on sale. And that was my daily habit. And it got very troublesome. Troublesome to my aunt, to my uncle, that I was coming home like this. I got troublesome to people that were with me, because I was driving recklessly. 405 Parkway, the Ventura Boulevard, you know, California. It was a nightmare. My girlfriend at the time and my friend were in the back, were driving, and I was doing 90, 95 miles an hour, and they were screaming to get out of the car. And the louder they screamed, the faster I went. And finally, I just dropped them off at Denny's, and I said, "That's it, get out." And I went back home, and I cried. I cried myself to sleep, knowing that this is probably it. You know, I've probably done it for the last time. I'm beat. You know, this alcohol is kicking my butt again. And what am I going to do about it? Uncle Dave, all right, and I guess, you know, this whole thing was written out in some sort of manifesto that he's going to hit bottom on so-and-so day, and I'll tell him about my meeting on Sunday night in Chatsworth, and I'll ask him to go with me. This whole thing was planned out. And he said, you know, I do an AA meeting in Chatsworth. I would like you to be there. And I said, okay, I'll go. I'll see what this is all about. You know, not knowing I would say that I was an alcoholic, not knowing that I would fit in with the people that were around the room hearing their stories. I just figured I'd go, I'd listen to what they had to say, I'd get them off my case, and I'll go back to do what I was doing, which was drinking and getting in trouble. The job did not suffer. I wasn't exceeding up the ladder as fast as I would like, but the job didn't suffer. I went to the meeting on Sunday night, and we went to a locked room, a locked ward in the hospital, in a room, and the people in the room came in with robes on, with no ties, and shoes with no laces. And I found out that they don't have laces, they don't have ties, because they used to hang themselves in the rooms. These were locked wards, and these were people that weren't getting out for a while. So they had no ties on their robes, no shoelaces. And as they went around the room, I would hear bits and pieces of my story. Oh, how I was successful, how I was this, how I was that. But then I started drinking, and boom, you know. And as they went around the room, I was hearing more and more, "That's like me. That sounds like me. That's what I did. Those are the things that I did." And, you know, they were getting to three or four people before me. And in my mind, I'm saying, "What am I going to say? What am I going to say? All right? Do I say I'm an alcoholic just to, you know, appease everybody? Do I say pass? Do I say nothing? What do I do?" You know, didn't know what to do. So the next guy says this, that, and the other. You know, "I did this. I just got out of prison. I'm here. Blah, blah, blah." And it comes to me, and I guess I was the last person to speak that night. And they pointed to me, and I said, "Hi, my name is Howard, and I'm an alcoholic." Don't ask me where it came from. I have no idea. I wasn't going to say that. You know, I was going to say pass, or I was going to say, "Hi, my name is Howard, and I feel bad for all you guys, but, you know, I don't, nothing like that." But something said, you know, something smacked me in the back of the head and said, "You're an alcoholic," and admit it. And I did. And, you know, like the book says, you know, scales of Pride and Prejudice just came, you know, running down my face. And I got home that night and I cried. And I admitted I was an alcoholic. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't admit that my life was unmanageable. Listen, now, you know, I'm a manager at Circuit City. I'm making $40,000-$50,000. This is 25 years ago, so it's decent money. How could I say that my life is unmanageable? I never missed a day of work. But I knew alcohol was something I couldn't drink. I didn't know why I couldn't drink it. I went to meetings in California. David hooked me up with a sponsor. And he said, "Do what this guy tells you to do." I said, "Okay, what do I know? I'll do it, whatever, I'll do it." And, you know, I'd call him on the phone, and he was running a big industrial equipment company, and And when he had time to talk, he had time to talk. When he didn't have time, he didn't have time to talk. And I didn't understand how it worked. I figured if I call, I'm important. He better pick up my phone. He better pick up the phone call. And, you know, his secretary said, he'll get back to you. And sometimes he would get back to me right away. Sometimes it would be a day or two later. And and he would pick me up at night once or twice a week. We'd go to a meeting. The other nights I'd go with my uncle. And we went to a meeting one night in this gym. I don't remember where it was. But I know that there had to be close to 1,000 people in this gym. And all the meetings were huge, huge meetings. And he said, I want you to go up there when they start saying, when they ask somebody to read the steps off the shade, I want you to go up there and do it. Okay. And I went up there and I got up to the fourth or fifth step. Not a problem. You know, I've dealt with, you know, crowds before. And all of a sudden my knees started wobbling and I started shaking and I couldn't do it anymore. I was like this. I was nervous. I finally got nervous. And I knew that, you know, this is it. You know, I've got myself into something that I'm never going to get out of. And I went on with this, and I went to different meetings, and, you know, we went to celebrity meetings, and there was people that I met, you know, that would drive up in Rolls Royces and limos and the whole thing, and they would sit down and, you know, next to me, and David would say, this is so-and-so, or that's so. I had no clue who they were. No, I could care less who they were. Didn't matter to me. You know, if it was a Yankee player, it was Don Mattingly sitting next to me, then yeah, I would be, I would be, you know, I'd know who that is. But I had no idea. But these people, you know, big dollar people that had this, you know, same problem as I did. I don't know that I heard the solution. I don't know that I heard the program of recovery. I don't know that I heard, you know, the God portion. I don't know that I heard that. If I did, then I apologize. But I don't remember hearing it. You know, they told me to read the book, and I read the book, and they told me to do a fourth step and to write, and I said, okay. And I just wrote. I just wrote whatever came to my mind. No one said that this is what you were supposed to do. I didn't understand what it said in the book. All right? They said, write, and I wrote. And I wrote a notebook full of stuff. You know, gibberish. You know, this is how I feel. And that was gibberish. And my sponsor said, oh, that's good, that's good, that's good. You're writing things down. Okay. And I felt better after writing it down. I don't know what I was writing. It was gibberish, and this is how I felt. I hooked up with a woman, really out of false pretenses. You know, it was a lie on my part, a lie on her part, and we got together, and it was war from the beginning. It was a bad relationship, but I couldn't say that. I failed again. I was tired of failing. I couldn't say that I failed, so we tried to make this thing work, and it was horrible. The meetings weren't that good, but Circuit City was great. They loved me there. They loved me to the point that they called me into their main office, and they said, we'd like to send you to Florida to run one of our stores in Florida. In North Miami Beach, which we all know is, you know, the snowbirds from New York, so I fit right in with the New Yorkers. The Jews from New York were down in North Miami. So they said, yeah, you'd be a perfect fit there. I said, sure, why not? I'll go. You know, I had family down there. So they, three guys knocked on my door with the Mayflower moving truck. They put everything that I had in my apartment, including my car, in this truck, and they said, all right, here's your airline tickets. We'll see you in Florida. That was great. Absolutely. It was fabulous. I got down to Florida and I met all my, you know, all my countrymen. And I did well there. You know, I did well. I was the audio video manager and the appliance manager, and then And we did well, and and I was climbing up the ladder again. Except I had nothing in my life. I was with this girl, I terrorized her. I terrorized myself. My brother lived across the parking lot in another complex, across the parking lot, and I saw him twice, and I was in Florida for 4 years. I was embarrassed to see anybody. She would piss me off, and I would break something. I'd put my hand through the wall. I just had nothing in my life, and it was business. It was all business, and I would go to work just because I felt successful there. Everything else in my life was a disaster. Didn't drink, but I had, the emotional downturn, and I was close to bottom again. If anybody in the program knew me, they would buy me a drink. That's how bad I was. Matter of fact, they'd probably buy me a bottle. Yeah, go get drunk. You'll be better off. Anyway, my brother was graduating college, and my grandparents from New York came down, and they asked me to come back and run the business in New York. And that was it. I had arrived. Right? First, my grandfather says, I'm worthless. Now he wants me to run the business. And I thought that was it. I thought it was over. Right? My life has just been completed. Everything I've ever wanted for and dreamed of was now here. Unbeknownst to me, the business was suffering. It was hurting. My uncle was single-handedly destroying the business, and my grandfather couldn't do anything about it. So they brought me in to see if I could try to save it. Didn't know that at the time. I got to New York, made some changes. Things were starting to get a little bit better, and all of a sudden, we started doing construction, and the electricians started to. Finished their work at night. We had to do things at night. We couldn't do it during the day because we didn't want to close the store. The electricians were finished with their work, and they took a beer out of their cooler, and they drank half a beer, three quarters of a beer. They put it down and they went home. So I said, okay, didn't bother me for the first day or two. The second day, I'm saying, what's the matter with these people? It's a good cold beer. Don't ruin it. Don't waste it. And they drank half, went down to the bathroom to get rid of that half, and they came back up and the can was empty. Where did it go? Howard started drinking again. Didn't take long before Howard was buying six packs for his 13-mile drive home. Didn't take long where there was bottles of vodka in my desk. Didn't take long where I had, long before I had Drambuie again, and the dry goods as they're called. It didn't take long before all that happened, and I was back to where I was. At this time, I forced my grandparents to get rid of my uncle, to fire him. And I took complete control of the business. I had a game plan, and my game plan was working. It was working. I didn't have the necessary time to do it, nor did it work to where it should have because of my drinking and my drugging. I know that now. I know that it was my fault that the company, partly my fault for the company failing. And I live with that every day. I knew I had to be separated from alcohol because when I was in California, things got better. My ex-wife at the time hooked me up with rehab, and I guess it was in Plainview. I went there 5 days. On the third day, I was feeling unbelievable. This girl was having a seizure in the bathroom, and I was one of the ones that helped her not swallow her tongue and helped her get back up on her feet. And all of a sudden, the heart was thumping, all right, and the blood pressure was raised, and I felt alive again. by helping somebody else. I never felt this way before. And by the fourth day, I was listening to people who came into the rehabs and shared their experience, strength, and hope. And I was starting to feel alive again, that there was hope again for me, that I was going to be able to do this again and be successful at it this time. My ex-wife found a meeting in Valley Stream where I lived, and it was at Olivet Church. It was in March on a Saturday night, and I swear I wasn't going. I was not going. Got out of rehab Saturday morning, and she said, "All right, you will go to this meeting." They said, "You got to go." I can't go. I'm embarrassed. I might know somebody in these meetings. How am I going to go to a meeting and tell somebody I'm an alcoholic? I can't do that. Something walked me down those stairs in Olivet Church, and everybody here knows those stairs. And my sponsor was there. He stuck his hand out, that big giant hand of his, all right, and shook my hand and bought me a cup of lousy coffee and a stale cookie. And he says, "All right, sit down. We're going to go through this book." All right. So I said, "Okay, what book?" And it was the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And, he opened it up into the last page, then 569, where it's the spiritual appendix. And it says, "The personality change sufficient to bring about recovery has manifested itself among us in many different forms." So I said, "What?" He says, "Personality change is what's sufficient for you to recover." Okay, I'll do anything. I was beat up. I was done, finished. I'd kiss your butt in Macy's window, whatever you want. What's a personality change? And then we sat down. We went through the book. We went through the doctor's opinion. We talked about the physical allergy, that I have an allergy to alcohol. Well, to me, I didn't think I had an allergy. I drank gallons of it, all right? I didn't swell up, all right? My face didn't turn red. My throat didn't close. Nothing really happened other than me, losing a job, losing a family, wrecking a car, this, that, the other thing. But I didn't know that I was allergic to it. And he says, "Bozo, it says here in the dictionary, an allergic reaction is an allergy is an abnormal reaction to a drink, food, or such." So I said, "Wait a second, an abnormal reaction." I said, "Okay, I'm listening." He says, "Every time you pick up alcohol, your body now is craving for more. Is this true?" And I think about it. I said, "Yeah." He says, "When was the last time you went to a bar and had a half a glass of beer or a half a drink?" "Never. Even at my bris, I had to have the whole glass of wine." So he says, "Does this make any sense to you?" I said, it's getting there. And we went through the book, and he says, the book, Doc's opinion, said men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Yeah, no kidding. I like to get shit-faced. Don't want to say that on tape. I like to get messed up, absolutely. And it says, as we see people take drinks with impunity. I didn't want to be different than anybody else. I wanted to be like everybody else. I wanted to fit in socially. That's all I was trying to do for the 30 years of my life, was trying to fit in socially with everybody, But I didn't, because I crossed that line, all right? I have this allergy, the phenomenon of craving. And we went through the steps that are outlined in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And, we talked about how I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable in step one. And that was easy. Do you believe that? I said, "Well, yeah, sure I do. It's Saturday night. I'm here with you, of course. Alcohol is my master. I'm powerless over alcohol. I know that." He says, "Well, good. I'm glad you know that. If you're powerless over something, what do you need?" "All right, what do I need?" "You need the power. If your car doesn't have gas, it's got no power. You got to get gas for the car to have power." I said, "Oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense." So step two, Came to believe a power greater than myself is going to restore me to sanity. Okay, what does that mean? Well, that's the power that you have to find. Okay, where do I find this power? It's in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The book is going to get you to that power, and that power is going to remove the thought of picking up the first drink. Why is that so important? Well, it's the first drink that triggers the allergy. If you don't pick up the first drink, you won't trigger the allergy. And if I don't trigger the allergy, your body won't crave for more alcohol. Okay, that makes sense to me, because I can never just pick up one drink. That makes plenty of sense. All right, but how do I get rid of the thought? Well, obviously you can't do it on your own. So I said, okay. He says you have to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him. Step 3. What does that mean? It says you have to change your thoughts. If you change your thoughts, your actions will change. Huh? He says, yes. All action is born in thought. If I'm thinking about scratching my butt, I'm going to scratch my butt, all right? But if you're not thinking about it, you're not going to do it. So you have to get that thought out of your head about the first drink. I said, okay, I can do that. I can get rid of that. But there's these other things in my life that I didn't know about. I didn't know about selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, and fear that was controlling my life. And we find that out in step 4 when we do a personal inventory on myself. All right, what's the deal with me? I have to find out. I have to educate myself on me. They talk about in the book about a spiritual experience, that white light experience. Right? Doesn't happen to most of us. They talk about a spiritual awakening, which is an education that you learn more and more about yourself, on what makes you tick. And that's what the fourth step did. So I got this fourth step down on paper, and the book says it has to be on paper, because if you don't put it on paper, you really don't have ownership of it. All right? I've sat at the bar and spent thousands of dollars on my fourth step with the bartender, bitching and moaning, complaining about every little thing in my life. But once I put it on paper, I have ownership of it. It's mine. I can see it. I can see where I'm resentful. And we all know resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. I can see where I am fearful. I can see the people that I've harmed because it's in front of me now. So the first column is the name, the second column is the cause, third column is what part of self is affected. And I learned about self. I learned about I have a social instinct, I have a security instinct, and I have a sexual instinct. Social instinct, wanting to belong. I want to fit in. I couldn't fit in with anybody else unless I was drinking. But now I can fit in with people. Because I see more about myself. I see how I tick. My security. That's your fear. All right? You want to be secure for the future. If I'm not secure for the future, I have fear. If I'm not secure in my my personal relationships, I have a fear. And sexual. My sexual instinct. Wanting to reproduce. Wanting to replace me with, you know, my children on this earth. I learned about these things. But I also learned, as an alcoholic, I have the disease of more. Never satisfied. It's never enough. Never with the right person. Never the right kind. Never the right color. Never the right speed. Not enough power. This, that, and the other thing. All right. So I learned about that. I learned about myself. Having the disease of more, I need God to remove these thoughts. They weren't removed from me when I was drinking, because I would walk over you, I'd steal from you, I would cheat, I'd stab you in the back, I would do whatever I could to get what I wanted from you. But now I don't have to do that, because I have a power that's greater than myself in my life. that's able to solve all my problems. Not just my drink problem, all my problems. If I let him. If I don't take my self-will back. I didn't know these things. And these are the things that I learned by sitting down with a sponsor and going through the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have never in a million years been able to figure this out. So when people say, you know, I'm so-and-so and I'm a recovered alcoholic, I understand what that means. They're recovered from the mental obsession. And I thank God every day that I found AA. Because now I know what my problem is. My problem is me. It's not you anymore. Because I tried to change you for many, many years and none of you changed. So I had to change myself. And I can't do that by myself. Why? My thinking is what got me here. My thinking is not going to fix my thinking. I learned that here. And the book taught me these things. And the book continues to teach me these things. You know, the fifth step, admitted to God, to myself, and another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. I walked up here and I said that I'm selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, and frightened. Those are my grosser handicaps. Those are the things that the sponsor pulled out of me when we did the fourth and fifth step. I would never see it. I would never see where I was selfish. I'd never see where I was self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, or frightened. I would never see those things. But I needed somebody who's been through this process that was able to extract that from me. And then the sixth and seventh step, right? I had to admit to God that these character defects needed to be removed. And how do I do that? You know, it doesn't give much direction in the big book on, you know, removing these character defects other than asking God in prayer and having the willingness to have these removed. But once I saw these character defects, then I could do something with them. If I didn't know what they were, they would continue to run my life. But now that I see them, I have ownership of these character defects. So now when I go to the delicatessen, I give him a $10 bill, and he gives me change of 20 instead of sticking it in my pocket and running, saying, ha, 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 ha. I don't do that. I say, excuse me. All right? Or when I'm at Costco, I don't push the cart down the aisle, you know, down in the parking lot. I bring it back to where it belongs. Because how many times has my car been scratched by morons like me who just throws the thing down the... These are the things. Do I continue to upset my wife? Absolutely. Do I continue to be a rat bastard? Yes, sometimes I do. All right, and that's part of life. But it's not the extent that it used to be. It's not a week-long, all right, event any longer. It might be a half hour, it might be an hour, and I might catch myself and apologize. And make amends right away. So six and seven, I have ownership of my character defects. I know what they are, and I know what I need to do. I have to do the exact opposite. And that's a spiritual awakening. Steps eight and nine, I have to make amends to the things, to the people, and the places that I've hurt. And that's not an easy thing to do. But I know that if I had the ability to do the things that I did, then I better find the courage to make amends for those things, those hurts that I did, the harms that I did. If I have to search out these people and make amends for the things that I did, for the stealing and for the lying and the cheating and whatever I did, I have to do that because I have to humble myself. And if I don't do that, then I'm full of myself, which is full of self-will. And self-will is what got me here in the first place. And I know I can't live that way. Steps 10, 11, and 12. Step 10 is 4 through 9 on a daily basis. I'm taking a daily inventory of myself. What did I do wrong? Who did I wrong? What character defects are starting to increase? All right, what are starting to take over my world? All right, am I living in fear again? Am I not doing the right thing? You know, step 11, I'm having a closer contact with God because that's what I need. Every day is a day I want to be better than the day before. And I have to get closer to God in doing that. If I don't, then it's all me. And I know all me is all no good. Step 12, I have to practice these principles. It's my responsibility to practice these principles, to carry this message to other people. Because if I don't, where is Alcoholics Anonymous? It's not here anymore. It disappears off the face of the earth. And how could I let that happen when it's done so much for me? It's saved my life. It's given me a life that I would never imagine. I have to return the favor. I have to give this back to the people that gave it to me. And that's what, you know, what I came up here and said, that I hope just one person gets this message. And I hope that one person is able to take this message and help somebody else so this program thrives, because it is an amazing program. It has given me things, again, that I would never. It's given me the absolute perfect wife. It's given me the perfect children, all right? I won't tell them that because... But it's given me two unbelievable kids. It's given me a family that I've never had before. It's given me things that I've never even dreamed of or could dream of. And it's because I carry this message and I practice these principles, not in all my affairs. I'd be lying if I told you I practice these principles in all my affairs, right? But I do my best most of the time. And I try to live the right way now. I'm not that selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, frightened little boy that came in here 16 years ago. I have grown. I have grown. Am I immature? Yeah, I'm immature. My wife will tell you that. But I am growing, and I continue to grow every day because of this program. I want to thank the group, the Primary Purpose Group, for letting me carry this message to another still sick and suffering alcoholic. And hopefully I made some sense. Thank you very much.